This is Division 7 of the Court of Appeals. To my left is former Chief Judge Rivera, Chief Justice Rivera. To my right is Judge Jones. And I'm Gilbert Roman, Judge Roman. And this is the final argument in this building. So there's some trivia that will go into this particular argument. So welcome to the parties. There's one case on the docket today. That's Serbo versus Protect Colorado Jobs, 09CA0587. I see that counsel are present and that counsel is experienced. So I'll remind everyone to turn off their cell phones. And beyond that, I would just note that the parties have asked for and have been granted an additional 5 minutes each for their arguments. So you have 20 minutes. And you can divide that up as you see fit. With that, we are ready for argument.
May it please the court. My name is Mark Ruskin, representing Michael Serbo. With me at council table is Monica Marquez of the Attorney General's office. Ms. Marquez will be arguing the constitutional issues before the court. I will be arguing the factual issues. And I might note that Ms. Marquez's presence at the appellant's table is not meant to indicate an endorsement or lack of endorsement on the factual issues, but it might facilitate communications in this historic argument. So thank you, and thank you for allowing us to have a little extra time. We will divide our time and reserve what is left for rebuttal. This is a case about two men. Two men who participate in conversations in March of 2007 about launching an initiative, a right-to-work initiative that ultimately ends up on the ballot. They take that conversation and move forward and form Protect Colorado Jobs, the entity at issue here, in May of 2007. So a couple months after this has been allowed to gestate, the first step is taken. And the very next month, the first ballot initiative is introduced. And it begins to go through the process. And it continues through the process over the summer of 2007, where it is defined and then withdrawn because of some single subject issues, replaced by a new issue in August, which goes through the title setting process and ultimately becomes a ballot issue under that terminology for purposes of Colorado law. I might note as a parenthetical that the reference in our brief to what makes or doesn't make something a ballot issue, that is, going through the title process and getting through the motion for rehearing, we referred to the Colorado Secretary of State's rule on that issue. That rule has since been replaced by an identical statute found at 1-45-108(7) in the Colorado Revised Statutes. Having become a ballot issue then, these two individuals, one a lawyer who drafted it and the other a political spokesperson, take the process the next step forward and get a petition form approved by the secretary in November. And they file their issue committee called Colorado Right to Work Committee. And in December, they sign a paid circulator contract and out of Protect Colorado Jobs' pocket, pay directly $45,000 to advance the paid circulation. And then for the next 4 to 5 months, every time the Colorado Right to Work Committee needs a check, almost down to the penny, Protect Colorado Jobs becomes that donor. And therefore, everything the Colorado Right to Work needs is given to it by Protect Colorado Jobs. And it's all run by those same two men. There's a third individual who's on the PCJ board, but as was developed at hearing, or in the undisputed record from a previous hearing, that was an individual who simply didn't participate much. So the issue before the court then becomes whether or not the ALJ correctly found that PCJ, because it was formed in May for purposes that might have been broader than just advancing this measure, whether the ALJ erred in finding that PCJ didn't actually have a major purpose of advancing this measure. And for that purpose, I would suggest to you that there are numbers rather than words that are pivotal for you. And there are three numbers. One is 100. One is 73, and one is 65. 100% of everything that PCJ gathered in its first 11 months was spent to advance the initiative so that they could be advocates of the initiative. 73% of everything that PCJ gathered and spent through the time of the hearing in July 2009 was spent to advance this initiative. And 65% of everything that PCJ planned to raise and spend through the end of the election cycle was dedicated to this ballot measure, and to being, in the words of one of the witnesses, one of the primary actors, being advocates of this measure. They said it was a big part of what we did, but the administrative law judge found that because they were formed with broad purposes, advancing the interests of business, educating the public, that they couldn't then develop a major purpose of advancing the issue. What the ALJ did, in light of the Secretary of State's regulations about multi-purpose issue committees, which are committees that may be formed for one reason, but because of what they do, they develop a major purpose of advancing an initiative and therefore have reporting and registration requirements. What the ALJ did was to take multi out of multi-purpose, because under the analysis of the ALJ's decision, an entity couldn't change, couldn't add, couldn't develop beyond what it says after the fact its original purposes were, because the Independence Institute case that's at the core of this matter before the court said that there were three tests for reviewing whether or not an entity had developed a major purpose. One was, what did it say in its bylaws and articles? And those weren't introduced. So that test falls.
Mr. Gruskin, wait a minute. In reality, what we should really look at, taking your position that we should review this de novo, the statutory language itself. Now, it says a major purpose. What does the indefinite article A stand mean as distinguished from the definite article the major purpose? What's your view of that?
My view, Your Honor, is that A allows an entity to have more than one major purpose.
Well, isn't that what we have said in previous cases, or the Colorado Supreme Court has said in other cases?
The Colorado Court of Appeals has certainly said that in the Independence Institute case, that you could have two or three major purposes because of the way that you allocate your resources and the way that you send particular kinds of messages. You don't have to have only one major purpose.
What is the purpose? Isn't our role as the judiciary to try and understand the intent of the legislature? And is the intent of the legislature expressed when it says a major purpose rather than the major purpose?
I believe you're absolutely right. Had the people, for instance, when they put Article 28 in the Constitution, wanted to regulate only those entities that were formed for the major purpose of advancing the initiative, they would have used the word the definite article, but they didn't.
I'm going to ask the same question to your opponent so to get his view of the matter, but I was struck by that particular application of the indefinite article A and the definite article, in the absence of the definite article the.
And I think that that is definitely worth noting, because it stands apart from some of the other statutes, campaign finance statutes, that have been upheld that use the major purpose. But campaign finance statutes, the Brunsickle case, for instance, the Independence Institute case, all indicate that a major purpose will withstand constitutional scrutiny.
Now, Mr. Gruskin, just to follow up on that, in the Independence Institute case, we were concerned with an entity that had this 20-something year track record.
Correct.
So, and over that long period of time, it had been involved in numerous activities, and partially for that reason did not have a major purpose of promoting a particular issue. Now, I'm concerned a little bit about this issue of time, because had the case hypothetically occurred 20 years earlier, when the Independence Institute was in its infancy, as this entity is now, it seems to me the result might have been different, because you would have had this track record to look at. You would have said, well, look, they were just formed 6 months earlier. They spent all their money in that 6 months on that particular issue. And so under your formulation, we would have said, well, they have a major purpose of promoting this particular issue. But with the benefit of 20 years of hindsight, that perspective changes, even though the facts really didn't change. And so here we have an entity that's in its infancy, but it may go on to exist for another 20-something years, just as the Independence Institute has,
right,
and be involved in numerous activities. So we, under your formulation, we could have a situation where it's declared to be an issue committee today, and then 10 years from now, it's no longer an issue committee? Are you comfortable with that kind of a result?
I'm very comfortable with that, because it's not just the benefit of hindsight that is allocated by those 20 years. What those 20 years provided was a track record. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals said in Independence Institute. What is your track record? What do you actually do? What do you actually spend money on? And what do you actually espouse? What are you talking about? The Independence Institute had 6 different policy centers, and it had operated for 20 years, and it had been involved in some issue campaigns, and then it had gone silent for periods of time. And the court said that's not a major purpose. But when you form, and that is all you do for that snapshot in time, you can diversify, you can probably change your objectives and never be an issue committee again. But at the point at which you're spending 100% of everything you take in, I don't know how you can not be an issue committee.
Well, I guess what I'm concerned about here is we got First Amendment issues implicated here, so we have to be careful.
Correct.
And if we say to this this entity now, you have to report and you have to register, and years go by, at what point does this entity know, well, we no longer have to report, we no longer have to register? I mean, how is it supposed to make that determination?
I think Rule 4.15 of the Secretary of State's rules answers your question, Your Honor, because you only report the contributions and expenditures that are associated with the ballot issue. And so at the point at which this entity, say, is no longer involved in a ballot issue in the 2010 election cycle, and let's use that example, it, to the best of my knowledge, it is not involved, and therefore it has no reporting responsibilities. It is the act of the entity that triggers its reporting responsibilities. And therefore, it is in total control of the ability to take itself out of this particular scenario. And I would also point out that the Constitution protects entities like this. Article 28, Section 9, Paragraph 2C, says that if you are an issue committee and you form a separate committee, separate account, all the discovery from any litigation is limited to that account. And therefore, it's only what you spend and what you are given that is subject to the litigation. And so not only can you take yourself out of the realm, if you decide to be in the realm, you can minimize your exposure. I'd like to...
One further question, Mr. Gruskin. Has the Secretary of State issued any regulations determining what a major purpose is?
No, Your Honor, he has not. I think that frankly, the concern about litigation is overblown in the almost 8 years since the Article 28 was adopted as part of the Constitution. There have been, to my knowledge, 4 cases where this has been litigated in state, in dozens of statewide initiatives, and hundreds of local measures. There hasn't been a plethora of litigation, nor has there been a plethora of confusion. Thank you. I'll turn time over to you.
Okay, we'll stop the clock until the Attorney General is ready.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Counsel. I'm Monica Marcus, Deputy Attorney General for State Services, registration number 28950. I appear today on behalf of the intervener, the Secretary of State, Bernie Busher. I plan to speak for approximately 5 minutes and preserve the appellant's remaining time for his rebuttal. The Secretary intervened in this matter solely to defend the constitutionality of the Colorado campaign finance laws. The Secretary takes no position regarding the merits of the underlying campaign finance complaint brought by Mr. Serbo. I have 2 main points today. First, it is important to note that PCJ raises its facial constitutional challenges only in the alternative.
Well, the magistrate doesn't have any authority to respond to that if that was raised there, does it? Does she? Or does
no, that is correct, and that
so
is that, why.
So the, how were they going to raise that if that is not in here?
And Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that PCJ should have raised the challenges below. My point is simply that here on appeal, where they are properly raised, they are raised simply in the alternative. So if the court...
Let's get through all of the fact. Why is not the decision by another division of this court, an Independence Institute, appropriate for us to follow?
It absolutely is, Your Honor. My second point today is simply that if the court chooses to reach the constitutional issues because it wishes to revisit the ALJ ruling below, there is no reason to depart from the holding in the Independence Institute case. There, another panel of this court considered and rejected the identical constitutional claims that are raised by PCJ here. The court correctly decided that the definition of issue committee is not facially unconstitutionally vague or overbroad. The Colorado Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court denied review in that matter, seeing no reason to disturb that holding.
The Buckley case talked about the major purpose. And of course, we have a major purpose here. With the major purpose, I can understand a 50.1% or more. But how do we know what a major purpose is for purposes of vagueness?
Your Honor, just to provide some background here, the Supreme Court specifically adopted the phrase major purpose as a narrowing construction in Buckley to save the definition of political committee from unconstitutional vagueness. The court expressed the concern that absent this narrowing construction, the definition could be construed, a definition of political committee could be construed to reach groups that engage purely in issue discussion. The court's construction, however, allowed for some flexibility. By using the word major as opposed to sole or exclusive, the court was necessarily recognizing that organizations often do have purposes other than electoral advocacy.
Ms. Marcus, but the court also used the definite article the.
Yes,
the Buckley
it did.
Court did. And the concern is between the definite article and the indefinite article. We can see that if you have two purposes, that one might be a major purpose. If you have three, one might be a major purpose. But at some point along that line, once you have 10 or 20 or something, how can you determine what a major purpose is? Let's say they spend equal amounts of money on 20 different things, equal amounts of time on 20 different things. Where do we draw the line? And more importantly, how does an entity like PCJ know where to draw the line?
Your Honor, first of all, I think that while one can imagine 10 or 20 different purposes that a group may have, at some point it no longer becomes major. I mean, you have to use common sense. Major means major. The leak decision that the panel in this court decided not to follow, even the majority there refused to engage in any kind of line drawing. The footnote, I want to say footnote 6 in that opinion, recognized that the complainants there had specifically asked us to draw like a 50.1% line, and the court concluded that it wouldn't go there because it didn't feel that that was necessarily the only way that it could apply properly the Buckley test. And again, to go back to Buckley, what Buckley was trying to do was impose a narrowing definition so that the major, again, a major purpose of electoral advocacy, if we limit political committees to those that have a major purpose of electoral advocacy, then we are going to target, by definition, activities that are campaign related. And I think Colorado's definition, even though it uses the article A instead of the, still accomplishes the same result because it still targets the area of regulated activity to that core campaign-related activity. This is coupled with, of course, the Secretary's narrowing construction, which is that for a multi-purpose issue committee, that multi-purpose issue committee need only report campaign, specifically ballot issue-related activities. Anything outside of that does not need to be reported. As a practical matter, I would say that in the Secretary's experience, most groups that want to get behind a ballot issue or ballot question will form an issue committee that is solely and exclusively dedicated to that purpose. This overbreadth concern necessarily only applies to that rare entity that would consider itself a multi-purpose issue committee. To prove facial overbreadth here, they need to show that that overbreadth is both real but also substantial in its sweep. I think as a practical matter, there are very few such issue committees out there.
Well, there are a lot of entities I can think of off the top of my head. There's a lot of lobbying activity, Chamber of Commerce, the Cato Institute, the Independence Institute. I mean, there are a number of these kinds of entities that lobby and petition and promote a variety of issues and candidates. So I don't think it's that far-fetched to say this is a fairly common dilemma for these kinds of entities. I mean, how is the Independence Institute supposed to know? They've been around 20-something years. How are they supposed to know that something they're doing is a major purpose as opposed to the major purpose? So they're supposed to look at the last 5 years of what they've been doing, the last 23 years. How are they supposed to?
I think that to look at the life of the organization is a nice principled way to approach it. That's exactly what the ALJ did in the Independence Institute case. You can look up into the point where the complaint is filed. You can look backwards and look at that track record up through the present day. What does that track record reflect? We look at the articles of incorporation, bylaws, other public statements made by the organization, its actual activities, its expenditures relative to its total budget. I think that totality of the circumstances approach is perfectly appropriate. What I don't think you can do is necessarily project forward, because we might say, sure, we have all these plans to do X, Y, and Z, but at the time that the court or whoever is trying to make that assessment, you can't necessarily speculate what will or will not come to fruition. So I think a principled way to look at it is today, looking backwards. What does that track record reflect? That track record might be 20 years long. That track record might be 6 months long. But I do think that that's really the most principled way to take a look at the organization's global activities and to take a totality of the circumstances approach.
So you're comfortable, as I asked your co-counsel, with the idea that an entity might be an issue committee at its inception, but over time, somehow, at some point in time, morph into something that is not an issue committee?
I recognize that my time has expired.
You can answer this question.
Yes, I am very comfortable with that notion. I think that, in fact, an issue committee, a group that starts out with a particular purpose may change its purposes over time, and when it no longer has a major purpose, it is perfectly permissible to shut that issue committee down, and the Secretary's rules allow precisely for that process.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Scott Gessler. I'm here on behalf of the appellee. It's an honor to be in this court in the very last oral argument in front of with capable counsel on an important issue. I'd like to directly go to the A major purpose issue. It seems as though many of the court's questions revolve around that. And I think this case in particular demonstrates the deficiencies and the problems with the test A major purpose versus the major purpose. And we do respectfully ask that this court render an opinion that disagrees with the Independence Institute's prior decision. As an initial matter in the Independence Institute, we respectfully believe that the panel in that the panel there used the incorrect standard when looking at vagueness standards. Basically, we believe that the court there conflated an overbreadth analysis with the vagueness analysis. And the vagueness analysis is whether or not a standard provides fair warning, whether it's clearly defined, and whether it provides fair warning or allows arbitrary and discriminatory application or inhibits protected expression. And that's from the Buckley case. Here, frankly, there are practical challenges to those regulated. Obviously, I, as others here, are an attorney who needs to advise people. And if an organization comes to me or another law firm and says, well, do we have a major purpose? Must we report? Are we regulated as an issue committee? There, I guess, are multiple standards that we can look at. If we go to the Independence Institute case, that panel said that provided a three-prong test, which it used as an example, a methodological example, and it provided a methodology, places that you can go to determine whether there's a major purpose, but it never said what the standard is, what that line is. And here we are, in fact, today called upon to draw those lines, or at least to explore them and see what they are. And it, for example, as an example, it gave the purposes of the organization. And to look at the charter, articles of association, or bylaws. Here, it seems, here, Serbo I think, wants to disregard that particular factor. So there's dispute on that factor itself. This factor was not entered into evidence here, although the lower court used testimony to substitute for the written items.
But Mr. Gessler, on that point, what disputed facts do we have here? Don't we just have basically testimony from another hearing that was just offered in at this proceeding? Aren't the facts here essentially undisputed?
I think there are some disputes here, Your Honor.
What are they?
For example, whether or not PCJ engaged in independent spending for a ballot issue. Here,
did it?
Your Honor, we believe it did not. It? No, it did not. And the reason why is...
What's the dispute then? It's the facts.
Well, the dispute here is that Protect Colorado Jobs spent money directly. That was characterized and that was treated by the same administrative law judge as a contribution to a separate registered reporting issue committee. It was considered a contribution. Serbo, however, views that as independent spending, independent from an issue committee, which itself triggered yet another reporting requirement on behalf of PCJ. So that's an example, I think, of a disputed fact. And I think that that Mr. Serbo's position is undermined by the lower court's decision here. I think the other disputed fact, fundamentally, is whether or not PCJ had a major purpose.
Isn't that a question of law?
Your Honor, we believe it's a question, it's
or
primarily
a question of law and fact.
Yeah, it is a blended question of law and fact, but it is primarily characterized by a factual determination. You know, you look at, in fact, in the Independence Institute, that court said that the lower court, the administrative courts, can make these factual inquiries. And in fact, the Independence Institute panel said that's what saves this statute or this constitutional provision from vagueness, is because the trial court is able to make these factual inquiries. In Rutt versus CEA, or I believe it's CEA versus Rutt, there were so many rounds in that litigation. CEA versus Rutt, that was where the court was called on to determine the definition of a political committee and whether or not something was a contribution. The court looked to the purposes. And it said, ironically, the same ALJ was involved in that case, but the Supreme Court said it's a factual determination, a clear error standard, and so they deferred to the lower court.
But counsel, we can accept the facts essentially as undisputed and still then have to reach the legal issue of what constitutes a major purpose, correct?
Well, I think the court could choose to do that. I think it would be, and I think the court should view the term a major purpose as a factual issue subject to the clear error standard, you know, something akin to like a negligence standard.
Explain to me what your view is on the reason the amendment, the constitutional amendment, used the indefinite article A as distinguished from the definite article the.
I think it's difficult to determine the actual reasons that the electorate did that.
Isn't
that
part of our role, isn't it? To find out what the legislature or the electorate was trying to do?
I think generally the answer is yes, Your Honor. However, sometimes, as in this case, the record is relatively devoid of specific references to that. This was an initiated measure in 2002, and I believe that the blue book that is oftentimes used by courts as an indication of legislative intent, or the analogy of legislative intent, electoral intent, is relatively, I think it's completely silent on A versus the major issue. I do think, though, the important issue here is the plain language of the measure itself. And A, as you correctly pointed out, is indefinite. I think I understand that in the Independence Institute case, and particularly the concurrence, disregarded the difference between an indefinite article A and a definite article the. But it does have an actual difference, because when you say the major purpose, there is a one major purpose, which indicates 50.1% or 50% plus becomes the major purpose. When you have a major purpose, we don't know if one out of three articulated purposes is major, or one out of four, or one out of ten.
Well, let's assume for the moment that a major purpose, based upon the facts in this case, found by the magistrate, that protecting Colorado jobs, the right to work law and so forth, was a major purpose of Protect Colorado Jobs. Do you deny that?
We do deny that, Your Honor. In fact,
it was not a major purpose.
That is correct.
It was the major purpose.
It was not a major purpose, Your Honor. And
okay. And so what was the purpose of the Protect Colorado Jobs efforts in this line if it wasn't a major purpose?
I don't think the court below made a determination of the major purpose.
No, I'm asking you.
Okay. I think as articulated by Mr. Barry and Mr. Cervini, the purpose of this organization was to foster a pro-business political and regulatory environment in the state of Colorado.
And in order to foster that pro-business event, didn't that become a major purpose of Protect Colorado Jobs?
I guess the question, as I understand it, Your Honor, would be, would perhaps the supporting or contributing to an issue committee, would that be considered a sub-purpose or for itself a major purpose?
On the purposes of the organization?
Well, I think independent, no, Your Honor, in this instance, if I am required to defend the a major purpose, and certainly within the Independence Institute framework, the Independence Institute framework laid out three factors. One is the written bylaws, articles of organization, or the charter of the organization documents. Mr. Serbo did not introduce any of that into evidence. He does have the burden of proof in this case. However, the lower court relied upon testimony as a substitute and said that there were a multiplicity of purposes, and based on that factor, this was not the purpose.
But Mr. Cervini himself stated right to work or the right to work issue was certainly a big part of Protect Colorado Jobs.
And I think that's appropriate for that snapshot and that period of time. However, Your Honor, I would also point out that under the Independence Institute test, the third factor says you look at the electronic or written submissions, and this is where the factual dispute over the contribution becomes important. PCJ never made any direct communications to people except for contributions to a registered reporting issue committee. My point becomes, Your Honor, yes, I guess we can ultimately we can argue back and forth on these points, and that's what this case is about. This case is about this argument. And at least I pointed out, I think here, at least two out of the three factors of Independence Institute are clearly in our favor. Independence Institute also pointed out annual expenditures, and I think this case looks at a snapshot of what PCJ spent its money on. But ultimately what happens here is, you know, PCJ hired an attorney to advise it. We fought this out in the lower court. We fought this out here. I think that in itself shows the vagueness of the a major purpose standard and sort of the chilling effect that that has on speech. I mean, in fact, you know, as I was saying earlier, that, you know, if you're trying to advise a client, you look at the Independence Institute standards. If one goes to the, for example, to the state's brief in this instance, the state, I believe, said that there are a multitude, let me get the exact language, the methods for assessing a major purpose abound. They say they abound. And I think that's great. They very well may abound. I think, though, to overcome a vagueness standard, the state has to tell us what they are. Not merely that there's a lot of them, not merely that they abound, but what they are.
Ask you this as to the facts of this case, which I think are basically pretty important, even though they say the appellant says they're not in disputes, you say they are. Berry incorporated PCJ as a nonprofit organization. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I think that is correct.
He served as PJ's secretary treasurer. Is that correct?
And that is correct, Your Honor.
And he's a registered agent and an attorney. Correct?
Yes, sir.
And served as his president. In November of 2007, Barry registered the Colorado Right to Work Committee as an issue committee for Initiative 207-208. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. Wait.
Cervini ran Colorado Right to Work Committee on a day-to-day basis. Is that correct?
Yes, sir, it is.
All right. And the Colorado Right to Work Committee was formed expressly to obtain enough signatures to have the initiative placed on the November 2008 general ballot. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
All that came out through testimony.
Yes, sir. And I think what that demonstrates is that Colorado Right to Work Committee was an issue committee, okay, that what you have here is people from Protect Colorado Jobs specifically trying to apply the law.
And didn't they support Colorado Right to Work Committee?
They made contributions to the Colorado Right to Work Committee.
How much of the money that PCJ raised went to the Right to Work Committee?
Your Honor, I heard Mr. Gruskin reel off some statistics, reminding me of Mark Twain's comment, but I don't know exactly, but it was a substantial portion. I think the evidence shows that it was greater than a majority. Certainly a greater majority of the money that PCJ raised.
Okay, thank you.
And I know that the state relies very heavily on Rule 4.15, but I would note a few things. One is that here we have an instance, and for much of the time, Mr. Serbo has argued that PCJ and Colorado Right to Work were merely alter egos of one another. But what you do have here is a group of people doing its level best to form and create a separate reporting issue committee that is required to report, that they recognize is required to report, and in order to report all of that spending publicly. So you do have that effort. And then I would also note, yes, sir.
Would you at least concede that we need to look at what an entity actually does and give that more weight than what it just says it might do?
I will certainly concede that that is a factor, and it's an important factor, Your Honor.
Isn't it more important than what it says it might do?
I think it may very well be, depending on the factual circumstances.
Well, here it seems to me we have an entity that says it might do some things, and the only one it actually carries out is the promotion of this particular initiative. So doesn't that weigh against giving much weight to what it says it might do?
Well, Your Honor, I think it did do some other things as well that were not that do not fall under the ballot issue committee regulations.
What did it do? What's in the record that it did?
The record is that it had actually developed a newsletter, and I recognize that it was about to send that newsletter out, but its resources were spent on that.
What did the newsletter refer to?
I think it was a generalized newsletter of 65,000 to people as well.
And how much did they spend on that newsletter?
I don't recall.
Okay, what else did they do?
Your Honor, what they were also about to do, and this is not in the record,
but what did they do?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's an unfair way to look, and with all due respect, an unfair way to look, because what happens here is we have an organization in its inception, and it gets quickly popped with a complaint before it's able to develop a lot of its activities, and this shows the problem. You know, people talk about the substantial burden. And we talk about the substantial burden, the vagueness, and the overbreadth standard. Mm-hmm. And this demonstrates that substantial burden, because what we have here is an organization in its infancy that quickly gets popped with a campaign finance complaint. I use the term pop in the slang. But it's required to devote a massive amount of resources to defending itself in both the public realm as well as in the legal realm. And I think the court should at least consider that as an activity that it did, because I think under any circumstances, sort of defending this type of lawsuit and trying to defend itself in the public realm as well against these types of accusations is an important thing. Now, one can say, well, that's just part of forwarding
it's
a ballot
circular.
Issue.
That's circular is what it is.
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think it goes, though, to your point, however, which is, the difficulty of the A major purpose of that standard is looking at, you know, an organization that has a track record of 20 years before it gets a complaint filed against it, versus an organization that has a track record of 6 months before it has a complaint filed against it.
Okay, let's talk about the time element.
Yes, sir.
I got to read the record in this case. In March of 07, Fraser and Zupa began to discuss the right to work provision. Is that correct?
I'm not sure if it was Fraser and Zupa, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
I believe in March of 07, what happened is Mr. Cervini, I think Mr. Zupa was involved in that, Mr. Barry.
Well, I'll get to that. I'm not reading all of my notes.
Okay, and I apologize if I'm not able to answer questions specifically.
In March of 07, several individuals, including Fraser and Zupa, began discussing a placing of a right to work measure on the next general election ballot. Is that correct?
I think that's one of the things they did discuss.
That was by testimony. Is that correct?
I believe so. However, Your Honor,
Later on, Barry, with the help of Cervini and Cole and Fraser, drafted the proposed right-to-work initiative, is that correct?
I'm sorry, what time period is that, Your Honor?
Within a couple of months after March of 2007.
I think what happened is they drafted a ballot provision which was not the ballot provision in question.
I'll get to that, yeah. But did they do that in a few months after March of 2007?
I think they did.
Okay. And then later on, a few days later after that, in May of 2007, the Right to Work initiative was listed by on the Secretary's website. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Now, in August of 2007, the title board set the title for the initiative. Is that correct?
I believe it was more around November.
That's all. But I just.
I'm trying my best to answer, Your Honor. I apologize.
All right. Well, if you don't know, say you don't know. In September of 2007, the proponents withdrew that initiative and submitted a new one. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. In November of 2007, Barry registered the Colorado Right to Work Committee as an issue committee. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
All right. Well, what I'm trying to get to is here's this organization, PCJ, which is just organized in a few weeks after, or you got to leave me with the impression that a short time after that, they were beset by litigation and didn't have a chance to really develop. Is that correct? Is that what you're trying to tell me?
Yes, certainly with respect to an organization like the Independence Institute that had a 20-year history.
Yeah. Right.
But from a practical standpoint, what's the Secretary of State or an outside entity supposed to do? Wait 20 years for an entity and see what it does? I mean, we can't foresee the future. Don't we just have to look at what has happened?
I agree that that's a very important factor, Your Honor, and I'm not disputing that at all. I guess what I am disputing is if I, as a practicing attorney, if PCJ as an organization, is able to understand what these standards are and what it's supposed to do and what it can't do with respect to regulation, it will follow them. I think the record here shows a good faith effort to do that, hiring an attorney early on, creating a separate entity, creating a separate account into which all of the spending on the ballot initiative was reported. I think ultimately what we're talking about here is the inability or the challenge of determining what a major purpose is. We're not talking about methodology. We're talking about standards here. And I don't think the standards are clear to enable an organization to be able to meet them and understand what they are in advance. I see my time is up, and I want to thank you very much, Your Honor.
And thank you, counsel, all of you, for your fine arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will be issued in due course. That concludes this court's docket and the last and final oral argument in this building. The court shall be in recess, and the bailiff shall so announce.
All rise. The court will be in recess, subject to call.
Nobody yet, huh?
No.
I guess there won't be anybody. We're gonna leave.
Okay.
Did you call Law Week? Do you have their number?
I don't think it was Law Week. It might have been.
Huh?
It was legal. I forget. It was in the email.
Yeah. Of course, there's probably an email on my computer right now letting me know what they're going to do, but...
Okay.